Hey guys, welcome to the Amber May Show. Oh my gosh, I have such a treat for you. Last time a couple weeks ago, we had one Project Veritas whistleblower. Today we have another one. I am so excited to talk to Nurse Jodi O'Malley. She was on Project Veritas. She was the whistleblower. She was the federal nurse that was like telling us, hey guys, they're not reporting the adverse events that are happening in the hospitals. And I think she was super, super brave to come out and share that information with you and I. And so today we get to hear her story in full because we only got small bits and pieces on the Project Veritas videos that went out. But before we get started, I want you to go check out my brand new website, theambermayshow.com. Thanks to jawd.com. That's JAWDD.com. They did a beautiful job. I am looking for employers who are not requiring the jab. So if you have a non-jab job, I want you to go to my resource page and fill out a tab so that I can partner you up with employees or people, job seekers looking for non-jab jobs. Hey, and if you want to work alongside me, I am hiring people who don't have to take the jab. So if you want a job and not the jab, go to the AmberMayShow.com. The job description for what I do is under the resource tab, and then hit me a message on the contact me page. And while you're there, check out the brand new store. I got some merch that I'd love for you to like check out. I'm super excited to get my own merch, so I got that coming to me, so check that out. And you know what, everything we're going to talk about in the show is going to be in the show notes, so make sure you always check out the show notes, always, 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 because I'm partnering with businesses to help save you money. For instance, right now is the perfect time to go visit drstellamd.com, get your ivermectin, go set up a telemed appointment, or go get her Covivites. Either way, just you got to do one or the other because you need to protect your immune system. Dr. Stella says prevention is key, so start doing that, or early treatment. So get that now and use promo code Amber May, one word, and save yourself some money. So drstellamd.com. Hey, and we want to support patriots, right? So go visit mypillow.com/amber, use promo code Amber, and save up to 66% off. Right now they're having Black Friday sales, so grab your stuff, grab your Christmas gifts. Let's support a patriot who's helped us, who's been fighting for election integrity. Let's help him. You can get your classic My Pillow right now for $19.98, regularly priced $69.98. So grab that now while you can. And if you're a business owner and you could use some extra cash, I have a friend who is the tax incentive agency. She helped one business owner get $134,000 in money set aside from the government. So go ahead, check the links below and get in touch with her. Well, without any further ado, I want to welcome my friend, my brand new friend Jodi to the program. Jodi, I am so thankful that you said yes, and I want to say I'm grateful that you were brave enough because what you did was really scary. You stepped out in faith, literally stepped out in faith. You did something that most people wouldn't do, and I commend you for that. And I think bravery begets bravery, and I think the more people that step out in their bravery, I think things will change for the better. But it's going to take a couple more people to say, hey, I know what I did is kind of scary, but it's I can sleep at night, I can look myself in the mirror, and I can say, hey, at least I tried, you know? So thank you so much for stepping out in faith and trying. But what finally made you like come out with your story about, and maybe we should probably back up and say, what are kind of the positions you took? Like what did you do in the hospitals? Like how did you come up with all this stuff? And then like what made you become brave in sharing your story?
So thank you for having me on. I appreciate it. And it's wonderful getting to know you as well. From the very beginning of the narrative being pushed out on mainstream media, the very first thing we saw was that death toll ticker. And I had just gotten done taking my son to go see or watching Jojo Rabbit with my son, my then 10-year-old. And I'm looking at this and I'm like, wow, like this is reminds me of propaganda messaging. And kept an eye on it because it was that new word novel that we kept hearing, novel, novel. But for us in the emergency room, we had, when this came out nationwide, we were all pretty confident that we had seen this virus that last flu season. So from November to, you know, February, March at that time. And we were getting a lot of patients in the hospital with respiratory-like illnesses that were testing negative for the flu A and B. And a lot of us had gotten sick, myself included. So when that whole narrative came out in March, I'd like to say that God just gave me the spirit of discernment over it immediately and was like, be careful of what you're paying attention to. And then came all the unscientific measures that everybody hopped on board with. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting there like just bewildered. And then I was doing more and more research and like, where did they come up with 6 foot distancing? Why are we telling people to stay home and not go outside? Then came the putting on the, I mean, we shut down surgeries and everything, right? They were calling the surgeries being shut down non-essential surgeries. But I don't think, again, the play on words that the media did. Non-essential surgeries were a lot of surgeries that are essential and preventative. Lots of people waiting to get their angiograms, right? Or their angioplasty, or their chemotherapy, or their surgery to get a biopsy done. So all of these things are like, these are essential surgeries. Mm-hmm. But their definition of it was like anything that wasn't imminent, like having an active heart attack. So again, you know, I just paid attention and then very quickly they had asked me to set up a tent for outside to monitor patients. And every single symptom known to man was on that. That I was curious about that. Like, now you're telling everybody for this respiratory virus, diarrhea, right? Stomach pains, muscle ache, all these things that were really all inclusive of a flu or a stomach flu. Mm-hmm. So that was questionable. Then they asked me to do the nurse triage line. Everybody calling in. To, you know, say, oh, I have the syphilis. What do I do? So I went through policy changes, procedural changes with them. I am a float pool nurse, meaning that they can put me wherever they want in the hospital once I walk in the door. So I come into work and they say, we need you in the ICU tonight. We need you in the ER tonight. We need you at the triage tent. Or what wound up happening was they were saying, we need you as hospital supervisor. So I worked as a hospital supervisor, I would say probably a good 60% of the time. And for those that don't know, the hospital supervisor is running the entire hospital when you're on your 12-hour shift. So any patient issues, any nurse issues, any employee issues from lab, housekeeping, you know, any department, CT scan, MRI, or not MRI, we don't have that there, but any department, doctors have issues. I have to address it immediately. And if I can't figure it out, then I have to escalate it to the CNO, which is the chief nursing officer, or whoever is taking call for that night. I think that they realized that my clinical skills were, you know, above par, and I could make decisions, which I would, and I wouldn't have to call them and ask them, you know. But again, hospital supervisor, we're also privy to the reporting of the numbers. We're privy to understanding what needs to happen for an employee to be sent home. So at that time, it was, okay, so let's just say an employee came to work and they had symptoms. And at the triage tent, they said, okay, no fever, but I have a runny nose and a cough. Now, it was up to us to determine if they were appropriate to work or not. Lots of things that happened like that. Getting admissions into the hospital, right? So a doctor would call me and say, hey, I have an admission for you. Do we have med-surg placement or tele-ICU placement? And I would work with the doctor. I would literally go in the patient's chart and appropriate for a med-surg admission, or we need to put them in ICU. And again, our ICU is not a typical ICU because it's a government facility. And I don't want to say government facility, but it probably is. We would ship a lot of people out to other hospitals, right? So our doctors, our ICU doctors, were really just essentially hospitalists. Whereas in another facility, our ICU doctor, most ICU doctors are like pulmonologists. I mean, they're critically care trained and to handle higher level of acuity. So then we got that going, and then the mask came on.
Let me ask you a question before we continue with the mask, because yes, I'm glad you're going to mention that. But you know, the rest of us were hearing, oh, the hospitals are full. They're completely full. And I was trying to think, I knew people that worked in hospitals and they were getting furloughed. And then they weren't, like you said, the non-essentials were being shut down. So then I was wondering, is it true? Were hospitals really full? Was your hospital really full to maximum capacity? Like we were being told on the news that hospitals are filled to maximum capacity. Was that true? Did that happen?
No, we never, the hospitals never, first of all, people need to understand that an ICU will operate on a typical basis around 80% capacity. Okay. So it doesn't take much to say, oh, we're almost out of beds. And, you know, for me working at other hospitals, I know, like, let's just say the one down the street for me, which is a level one trauma, there's been many a times that it was filled to capacity prior to 2020, you know? So again, that was scare tactic. I would look at the numbers because I'd have to report it to the EMR database where we can see every facility in Arizona and the state. And so, yeah, I mean, it was never this crisis situation where, oh my gosh, we're going to have to go open up this other hospital.
That was something I was really wondering. I'm like, I don't know, because when President Trump had those hospital ships, they weren't even full. And so I'm like, I don't know that this is really true, because A, you're late, you're furloughing off employees from the hospital, because I knew a bunch of them. And then I'm just like, huh, if you're not even having like essential stuff going on, then how is it full to capacity? So I'm glad you confirmed what I was suspicious of.
Well, I'll tell you, we can talk about that as well, about that Mercy ship. So at my hospital, it being a government facility, we have a lot of the core people, commission core is what they're called. They're trained, you know, they could be a doctor, they could be a nurse, they could be a pharmacist, okay? And they're in a branch of the military, or the government, I should say, that's called the United States Public Health Commission Corps, USPHS, something like that, right? Those people were the ones who were staffing that Mercy ship, okay, that was sitting outside of California. So when they came to our facility in June and help, and was there to help us as well. They, you know, I had talked to them. I was like, so is that ship full? And they're like, no, we only saw a few patients. I'm like, wow. And I knew nurses that went out to New York to make that COVID money and travel out there, and they were sitting and chilling in the hospitals. I mean, in the hotel room.
Yep,
But
we're
then I
being
had someone.
told, hey, it's full to capacity, it's full to capacity. And it scared the crap out of everyone because the hospitals are full to capacity. I'm like, I don't think so. I don't think so. How are my friends sitting at home on furlough and the hospital is stuck to capacity? I'm like, okay.
And for us, we did not see our first wave of patients until July of that year. So I believe they shut down surgeries in April. They reopened it in May, maybe even April. It's kind of blurring together. April or May, they reopened it. And we were chilling. We were chilling, eating all this free food, watching videos in the ER. They had people so scared to come to the hospital that those people that really needed it didn't show up.
Wow.
Right? They didn't even they weren't coming. And then let's put this into perspective. So if you have your diabetic, right? You have your alcoholic, you have your psych patient, which is a lot of the people that we see in emergency rooms across the nation quite frequently, or even chest pain, right? Anxiety attacks, those kind. And then you start to test them for COVID after they died. And then you add that to the number.
That happened? I didn't even know that happened after they died. I had no idea.
Everybody, yeah. Oh no, we were testing everybody post-mortem after they died to see if they had COVID. And that is, I mean, not, you know, necessarily in our facility, because a lot of these people probably died at home or somewhere else, but everybody that died, they were testing for COVID and adding it to those numbers.
And you
And
gotta ask
so
yourself, why are they doing that? Because you have to follow the money. I feel like if people are getting compensated for this COVID stuff, are their hands really clean, or are they doing stuff and manipulating stuff so that they can get paid? And I'm not talking about necessarily doctors or nurses because I don't know that they got the money for it. I'm not sure, but I know hospitals did. I mean, and so are your hands really clean at that point if you're making policy specifically to get money? Like extra money, like to me, I'm like, makes me question your choice of your choices or your mandates or your policies you're putting in together. Anyway, I'm sorry. Continue.
Yeah, well, no, that's what I mean. That's what they did. So these things are happening very early on. And when you would hear, oh, you know, this person died in a car accident, but they're listing them as COVID because they're testing them after they died. How in the world does that make any difference to us?
Doesn't. Not at all.
No. And then, yes, you're right. They changed the coding. Every diagnosis has a code, and that's how they bill out. Well, they added a new code, the ICD-10 code, I believe that was ICD-10, and they added it, which were both together. So a positive PCR test and a presumed positive. So again, if somebody came into the emergency room and they needed to be admitted for their gallbladder taken out, and they had a positive PCR test, now what they are doing with that patient is they're labeling them as COVID and putting them on a COVID unit. Now, if you have somebody, let's just say a break in the leg, right? So we need an ortho nurse, okay? An orthopedic nurse. They would pull that orthopedic nurse from their floor to go up to the COVID floor to take care of this orthopedic patient. Now that nurse is a one-to-one, and then you just short-staffed your ortho floor. Does that make sense? And I'm just like, but this person isn't even clinically, like, they're not, it's no clinical significance. They're not coughing, they're not sneezing, they don't have a fever, there's nothing. They broke their leg.
So,
No, to me, I was just like, what are we doing? And then people were like, yeah, but it's deadly. And I'm like, to who? You know, honestly, those numbers that they came out with early on in China, and they said it affects the elderly. It does not affect our kids. But then we shut down schools and we stopped teaching our kids.
It was insane. Insane. So what are your thoughts on the PCR test? Do you think they are a good source to determine
No. That PCR test, all you have to do is look it up, which people don't do, and it tells you, number one, it was never meant to be a diagnostic test. Okay? They were supposed to use their clinical skills. But if somebody comes in and says, I have a sore throat, you're labeling them positive anyway.
They could have had strep.
And here's the thing. There was no gold standard. So there's still not a gold standard. I like to say it like this. If a woman wants to find out if she's pregnant, she gets an at-home pregnancy test. You can get the cheapest one, or you could get the most expensive one. But how they're going to determine if you're pregnant is the same across the board, right? It's the same. There's a gold standard, meaning that when that woman pees on that stick and it shows positive with 99.9% certainty, she is pregnant. With the PCR test, there was no certainty. It was never meant to be diagnostic. And here's the thing. There was no gold standard. So when I went to our lab department and I was looking up like cycle thresholds, so I'm educating myself on this and I'm hearing cycle thresholds between 17 and like 28 showed if somebody tested positive in those threshold numbers, it was clinically significant, meaning that they had a large chance of infecting someone else. Okay. They're sick. Okay. Our cycle threshold went up to 51 cycles. That's what our lab technician said. And it's like, when I heard that, so it's almost like, say, you get a license plate. Okay, look at a license plate and tell somebody that there's a blemish on there and you need to find it and you're looking for it and you don't see it. So you keep magnifying it. That's what a cycle threshold is magnification. Now we're zooming in to try to find it. Do we see it? And finally, you know, at these high cycle thresholds, be like, okay, well, you know, at say 15 or 17 to 28, yeah, we see that blemish and that could affect somebody from reading that license plate number, right? It's significant. We need to fix it. But if they keep zooming in and then finally they're like, oh, we see a little bit of something that represents a fragment. Does it mean anything? Is it blurring the numbers for somebody to look at? No. That's number one. And then in number two, you know, they said that they never even isolated the virus.
Right.
It's like a piece of it.
Mm-hmm. That's what I've heard too.
So we drove this pandemic off of two things. Faulty PCR testing that were never meant to tell somebody they were sick or not. And asymptomatic transmission, saying that you need to stay 6 feet away, wear a mask, hunker down in your home, and don't go see grandma because you can kill her and not know it.
I've never been told that in my life about asymptomatic things. I'm like, did they just make that up? Because If I don't feel sick, if I don't have symptoms, I'm going to presume I'm not sick because
Well,
I don't.
interesting for me, since I didn't believe in this whole narrative and I had science on my side, I was vocal at my job. I was telling people this the entire time. Okay. So it's interesting that they kept me in this position of authority because I was vocal. You know, I was vocal. And guess what? I had, oh, thousands of people test positive around me, right? Thousands. I mean, we're looking at, you know, a year and a half, and I was working 40 hours a week. I never once took a PCR test, never once. Now, through contact tracing, they would come up to me and say, "Hey, Jody, you know, so and so tested positive. Oh, that patient you cared for a couple of days, they popped positive. You want to go take a test?" And I was like, "Well, first of all, you know, I don't believe in it. Second of all, I'm not sick." And they're like, "Well, you know, if you want to take a test." And I was like, "Okay, but because I'm administration too, and I knew the policy, I said it like this. I said, okay, let me ask you a question. I go take that test and I'm positive, but I feel fine right now. I have no fever, no cough, no nothing. It's up to you and I to decide if I'm going to work or not. So would you send me home for 2 weeks?" And they're like, "No, I mean, if you feel fine." And I go, "Okay." So not one time did I ever take a freaking PCR test. I never walked around acting like I was sick. My family never took it. I never changed my life. I didn't strip it naked at the door. I didn't wear my hair in a head in a net and 10 mask on. Never. I mean, sometimes when I had to go into patients' rooms and stuff. But again, you're talking to an emergency room nurse. What am I supposed to do? Stay in full on PPE all the entire time? And
It's
then at
hot.
that point,
It's so hot.
and is it protective?
No.
Is it protective if I'm staying on full on PPE? No, it's not. And you never know what's going to walk through that door. Right. So, you know, we can have somebody walk through the door standing at 68% and, you know, breathing on you all over the place and coughing, maybe. And you know what I'm saying? And then at that point, you took them to the room and then you instituted your PPE precautions. But people would have their mask on already, take the patient into the room and still have the same mask on. Do you know what I mean? Like, I just, it,
So, are you telling me that the masks aren't science? That they don't stop you from getting sick?
the masks do not prevent viral transmission of an airborne respiratory particle at all. At all.
Yeah, we're being told on TV by the people in federal government, you need to wear a mask. You need to wear a mask. You got to protect yourself. Got to wear a mask. And I'm like, I feel when I was wearing a mask, I felt worse off. My husband especially cannot wear one. He would get headaches. He'd get lightheaded. I would get tired quicker. I'd get headaches. I didn't feel good wearing the masks. I hated wearing the mask. So after I complied for a little bit, and then I was like, nothing's changing, and everyone's wearing a mask, so I don't think it works. That's what my observation told me. I'm like, at that time, everybody I knew everywhere outside was wearing the mask. And yeah, on TV, we see the death toll, we see the numbers rising, and I'm like, if everyone's wearing a mask and we still have cases rising, that means it doesn't work. At least that's what my observation was. So I stopped wearing a mask. I'm like, I'm not wearing it anymore. It proved to me the science. They didn't even show you any scientific studies for the 6 foot distancing or the mask. They didn't show us any of that. And so I'm like, okay, done. Not gonna do it
Well,
anymore. Not gonna
because
do
there
it.
isn't any. There isn't any. I, again, Fauci came out and he said, "We're not going to wear a mask to stop a virus. Like, we're not going to be a nation of mask wearers. They don't do anything, right?" And then a couple months later, now he's like, wear one. Couple months later, wear two. Couple months later, wear three. And it's like, man, these people are nuts.
Yeah.
And imagine me being a nurse who knows better, walking around and seeing all of my colleagues that I respect putting this nasty, nasty thing on their face.
It doesn't make any sense how all these medical professionals are buying into it. I mean, not all, because then there's you, there's Dr. McCall, there's Dr. Stell, there's
99% of them practically are 95% of them. Yeah.
Yeah, my kids got discharged from their pediatrician because I brought the proof. Okay. I brought proof that it doesn't work. And I said, I don't want to wear these anymore. And he discharged us. He wouldn't even look at my proof. I'm like, you're a man of science. What's going on is not science. And here, I have studies. I can show you. Wouldn't look at him. I get a letter. He wouldn't even tell me he's discharging me. I got a letter in the mail saying I'm being discharged. And I'm like, you're a freaking doctor. I brought you studies and proof. How am I getting discharged? But I was kind of irritated about that. So it's surprising me how buffaloed people in the medical professions are, because we're trusting these people with our health to make good decisions for us. And if it's not even scientific and the observation was it didn't work, then why are we doing it? So you had an interesting story when you were speaking at our event, and you were talking about how you would test people's oxygen saturation levels. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So you have people coming into the emergency room with respiratory symptoms, trouble breathing. And a lot of times, or I wouldn't say a lot of times, but there were a bunch of people that literally were struggling to breathe with oxygen saturation. So for your audience, a normal oxygen saturation with no oxygen on room air is greater than 92 or greater. Okay. Anything less than 92, they want you to put the patient on supplemental oxygen. Except people that have like COPD and lung issues, they can go around 88%. So now you have somebody coming into the emergency room struggling to breathe, right? And you're triaging them with the mask on. Okay, fine. If you feel like you need to do that to protect people, which again is so insane to me, because they're not protecting people. We are hurting people, telling them to keep the mask on. And if anybody wants to look at who the experts are, that's what I did in the beginning. I found who's the experts in this. They're called industrial hygienists, right? Mm-hmm. They're the pathogen protection experts. Where are they? How come I don't see them anywhere?
No one saw them. Right.
No one saw them. Mm-hmm. And when I found them, they were like, listen, this is an airborne illness, which means that the particles are so, so, so tiny that they can stay suspended in the air for days, weeks. Okay. So if you get an accumulation of those little particles and you inhale it, most of it will be, bigger viruses, they're stopped by our nose and our mouth. But this virus, because it's aerosolized and so tiny, if you inhale a lot of it and it gets to your deep lungs where you're exchanging your oxygen for your carbon dioxide, then that at that point, that's where we saw, the issues. Okay. So again, masks do nothing to protect that. We need to be in full on PAPRs headgear, like you see in the movies. Mm-hmm. Okay. A number one. But so for that patient that had respiratory distress, okay, now we wheel them into the room and we place them on a monitor, still with their freaking mask on, a person struggling to breathe, and you're keeping that mask on. That is abuse. That is criminal to me. How are you telling them that you're so, okay, anyway. So what would happen when they were my patient, or if I was admitting that patient, and say the hospital's full. So the doctor, the doctor, lots of times they don't go in the room and see the patient anymore because of our, you know, lowering our risk for exposure, mm-hmm. they're getting report from the doctor or the nurse. Well, if the doctor or the nurse, you know, I mean, the doctor would probably go in, but like if you have your hospitalist come down who is admitting that patient to the hospital, mm-hmm. you know, and they don't go in the room or they're just seeing them, you know, like sitting there on the, with oxygen on in the machine. And I would be reading the number and I would say, oh my gosh, first of all, they're at 98% on 2 liters with a mask on. So my common sense is going to tell me that they're going to be fine if we take the mask off. So I would knock on the door a lot of times, say, pull down your mask. And I would be like, and then they would see me do that. And then I would watch their number rise. And then I'm like, okay, now take it off, take off. And then they would take off their nasal cannula and I would see it being normal. And then I would tell the hospitalist, hey, we don't, are you sure you want to admit that patient? Because they're satting 96% on room air. And he said, well, it was charted that they were at 82% when they came in here. And I'm like, yeah. First of all, because they had a mask on, they're having trouble breathing anyway because something going on. What do you want to do with them? And what would we do? What are we still doing? Telling people, oh, just go home. Just go home. If you can't breathe, come back to us.
Was that so, did that ever happen in the past before COVID where they would just tell you go home and then if you get really worse, come back? Or would they give offer something like go home, do this, 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 and this, and then come back if symptoms get worse? Like how was it before COVID? What did
it would be if somebody had, you know, say, no, we're having trouble breathing or anything, we'd be like, okay, well, you know, just take deep breaths. If you're coughing, take some Mucinex. You know, but here the discharge instructions were like, if you're having pain, take some Tylenol. There's nothing we can do for this.
Oh, wow.
And I learned early on with Zelenko that he was, you know, he was giving out hydroxychloroquine and vitamins and he was having good results. So I saw this information early on. I was following it. Right. And remember, we're chilling in the emergency room, getting fat, eating free food because nobody's showing up. Then they show up for the first time in July and we get our first wave. But at that point, we were sending everybody out. As many people as we could send out in other hospitals take, they were taking them. Now, I don't know, government contract, you know, whatever. I don't know if there was money involved in that or what, but we weren't really keeping anybody that was requiring more than like 8 liters of oxygen or something, right? They were sending everybody out. So I couldn't really attest to what was happening with them, but I know after they left, but what I can attest to is we had, you know, most of our employees were testing positive and going home. We're, you know, for 2 weeks. I mean, this whole narrative of like, go home, you know, isolate, stay away from, stay in your room, don't get sunshine, don't get fresh air. It wasn't any of like, hey, make sure you have some circulation in your house. Take some vitamin D because, you know, sit outside on your porch. And so that was what my, I knew all of this. Anybody that was paying attention or doing anything would have just done this. But nurses and doctors and everybody were like, oh, we're heroes. We're frontline workers. Rah, rah. We're so awesome. Finally, somebody's recognizing us. And it's like, man, I was like, don't even, first of all, don't even take a picture with me with that mask on. And there is no way I am calling myself a freaking hero when we're sitting here watching videos.
It's funny because they were calling you heroes back then. And now, answer this question for me. If we're still in a pandemic, how are they able to get rid or fire so many nurses and doctors who do not want to get the jab? I mean, how is that even possible? Like, that doesn't make sense. Okay. No. You guys weren't getting fired. supposedly at the height, when really the hospitals were not as full to capacity as they were saying. And you guys were heroes, but we're still supposedly in this pandemic. And if you don't get the shot, you're going to get fired. So then how the heck is anyone supposed to get help if they need it in the hospital? Like, that doesn't make sense. Can you help me make sense of that? Because
Doesn't make any sense. Doesn't make any bit of sense. No, that
so,
tells you a lot right there, right?
Right.
Like these people that you held on a high pedestal, now you're and went through this entire narrative with them, right? Dealing with the novel. Like, there's nothing novel about how a respiratory virus transmits. Do you know what I mean? It's a respiratory virus. All of this hand washing and stuff, that didn't stop this pathogen, because the pathogen is so small. It's like, you know, what we needed to do was tell people, hey, lose weight, exercise, get outside, eat some more oranges, drink some like almond milk.
Take
we
vitamin
didn't do
D.
that.
Yeah, zinc.
No, we take vitamin D. Take vitamin D.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't do any of that. And so when you asked me to go back and talk from what happened in the beginning, this is my mindset. As most critical thinkers that use common sense kind of knows, but they were paying attention to mainstream who was confusing them. And then you got the families involved and were like, man, you can't go, don't even think about like coming over to the house. We're hunkered down.
Yeah, I've experienced that too. What are your thoughts on the shot, on the gene therapy, experimental gene therapy?
I think personally, like I said, I had seen early treatment working, right? I was following the studies, following the frontline doctors, following Zelenko. I was in contact with a physician here in Arizona that was prescribing it. So in October, well, first of all, I looked at the numbers, right? And if you have a 99.7% overall survival rate, it's not affecting the kids.
Great.
And it's affecting the elderly, which get affected by pneumonias or respiratory pathogens all the time, right? So I never saw a need for it. I never saw a need for it. I still don't see a need for it. And then you're going to throw in there that it's going to be rushed and it's going to be a completely new technology that we've never used. And you're going to implement that to billions of people worldwide. Who's got the numbers? Who's following the data? Would you get 40,000 people, 40,000 healthy people? Like for me, I had a hard time with my natives. I was like, okay, who's signing up for this? Where's our clinical trial with just our Navajo Nation? How come we don't have that? But now you want to give that to all of them? And we're not talking about anything we can do to boost our immune system. So here's the thing I think about this. I am all for medical freedom, but I am also 1,000% for informed consent. And thank goodness I never had to administer it to anyone because I wouldn't. Right? But what I would tell people is like, you know, this is an experimental trial. And it's called, we're in the stage three portion of it, and it's due to not end until for a couple years. So you are in an experiment right now. Do you got somebody monitoring your signs and symptoms? No. Do you have any ingredient list that you could tell what you're injecting into people? No, they don't have to. It's under emergency use authorization. And that's where I had a big problem with Trump. I was like, why are you pushing this out when you came out a few months ago and said that hydroxychloroquine in your Regeneron treatment worked? Why are you, you know, but that's another story. You know, I wouldn't, personally, you need to be informed on what you are doing and what you are taking. Mm-hmm. And I followed so many people that were saying about bad things that could happen. And again, for an overall 99.7%, we're not even talking about that.
It's crazy. So when you were doing the Project Veritas video, we saw one of the portions where a friend of yours, a coworker, had a reaction to it. And I feel bad because you were crying and it made me feel really sad because I know what it's like to, I don't know if she's still alive or not, but I know there has been a lot of deaths associated with the virus. I mean, VAERS is reporting about 17, 18,000, and that's only 1% of all the reactions going on. It's the only data we really have. And so I know what it's like to lose a friend. And it was heartbreaking to me to see you crying because she felt pressure to get something she didn't want to get. And that broke my heart. And then as a nurse and as a supervisor, you were seeing people come in with reactions and you're like, guys, this is like a trial. We need to be reporting it. And yet people weren't reporting it. So how the heck are we supposed to get protected during this trial when people aren't reporting the reactions of the trial? So what are some of the reactions you saw when you were working at the hospital from people who had got the experimental gene therapy?
I had we had a ton of people come in with COVID after their first poke or second poke.
Wow.
And Indian Health Service released an adverse, their first reporting directive on reporting on October 20th. They released their first one and they put in there that an adverse reaction of special interest, adverse event of special interest, AESI, was COVID-19 disease after vaccination. Okay, so me, I'm saying like, come on, man, how did all these people who worked their entire time or been around people this entire time not contracted, but now they're contracting it after they get their shot? And then everybody's like, well, they waited too long. They should have got it 8 months ago when it first came out. And it's like, man, there's just too much of that. There's just too much. You know, people coming in with the 15-year-old that had blood clots in both of his lungs 2 weeks after vaccination. They're not even like thinking about it. See, what people don't realize is that video that was shown on Project Veritas was taken over approximately all those stories were taken over 3 consecutive shifts. So when I first had the first thought to record the pharmacist, because I was like, wait, we're denying? Okay, hold up a minute. I got to make sure that I hear what she is saying. And that's when I decided to record. Because at this point, we know that early treatment works. And we also know that it works with people that are hospitalized on oxygen. Why are we now, a year later into this, after our first wave, not doing anything different?
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. I mean, okay, so as far as I understand, they're forbidding ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine. And they're only allowing you to get remdesivir. And then what's the breath suppressant called? I can't remember the name of it. But there's
the what?
The breath suppressant they give you. So there's like this protocol that they give you. You get remdesivir, and then you can get this breath suppressant. And
Breath?
what?
Breath? You're saying breath?
Yeah.
Like your breath? Oh, like if somebody has a little bit of anxiety, they can get some Ativan. That's appropriate.
No, not that one. Like, I can't remember. Well, the protocols, anyways, that they're using right now in the hospitals. When I found out about the hospital protocols, I'm kind of like dumbfounded. I'm just like, why are we using this experimental drug that failed in the Ebola study to treat patients? Because in the Ebola study, it was killing patients, and we're tr using that medication, remdesivir, to treat people in the hospitals because remdesivir can stop your kidneys, can cause organ failure. And I'm just like, yet we have this ivermectin, we have this hydroxychloroquine, and physicians are forbidden from prescribing it. I don't understand that. Or they get threatened with their license, or you name it. I what has been your experience with patients using remdesivir?
Well, here's the thing. I did not know about the Ebola trial with the remdesivir. I did not know that they were using remdesivir in New York until I met Nicole from American Frontline Nurses. She was the original nurse whistleblower, right? That was saying they're killing people here. I didn't know any of that until I what came out with Project Veritas. Once I found that up, but what I did know and what most people know in the hospital is that remdesivir doesn't work. That's all we know. We know that it doesn't work. And even the pharmacy department's like, yeah, it's showing about 30% effective. And it's like, is it showing effective? Or are we now in my mind, I'm like, or are we harming people by giving it to them? Now what, knowing what I know now, I wouldn't administer that either. I would rather for my loved one, if they had to be in the hospital, not take it than take it. Let's put it that way. I would refuse it. I mean, so, and how is it a blanket protocol for everyone? Everyone. If your baseline labs show that your kidneys and your liver are good, then you can give it to everyone. So yeah, no, I didn't know about that until after I came out and then, met more people. But yeah, but what I did know, like I said, is that the FLCCC protocols and Zelenko protocols were working. I knew that.
I'll put a link in the description for anyone who's curious to see the Ebola study, because I heard about it from Dr. Artis, and he sent it to me, and I was like, oh wow, it was killing people in the study, and it was killing them by alarming rates, so they pulled it because it was also shutting down their organs, and so they stopped. It failed in the trial, but yet this is what we're going to use instead of tried and true methods, because ivermectin has gotten a Nobel Peace Prize. We've been using it forever. In some countries, it's over the counter. It's not safe. Yet we won't give that to them. We're not getting them vitamin D, but we'll give them this iver. We'll give them the remdesivir, and hopefully you'll do okay. Now, not everyone dies on that because everyone's body reacts different to medications. But there's a good amount of people that are dying from remdesivir. So if you have a person in the hospital, be very careful. And watch them very closely. As a nurse, is there anything you can instruct us with on how to advocate for our loved ones when they separate us and we can't go next to them, we can't be with them? How do we advocate for our loved ones? Do you have any advice for us? Because it's very frustrating being so far
Well,
away.
that was another thing I had a huge issue with was isolation of these patients. And also, like in my facility, they were changing our orders on how we need to report our vital signs. So usually a doctor will say, like somebody who is like more critical, it would be every 4 hours. Like an ICU patient would be every hour, okay? Like that kind of thing. They were changing it to be 12 hours. So only one time a shift did you need to document a patient's vital sign. Like, that's nuts. That's nuts. So again, so now, and then also too, you know, at first they were like, oh, we can't give them fluids, you know, it's bad for their lungs and everything. So now this patient sitting there on high flow oxygen, not eating or drinking anything. We're not starting any kind of nutritional plan. When you take away the advocate from the bedside, and you deem something that is an emergency in a pandemic situation, you got people that can do all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. Now, yes, were there times when we were busy and we, I mean, not in my facility, again, government facility, we weren't working. We weren't working as hard as some of the people on the outside because A, number one, we're guaranteed our 40 hours. And number two, they would bring in those commission corps to help us as well. Okay. And, you know, our other departments were like our OB department was shut down because they were investigating that. They had asbestos going on in the hospital. So that fifth floor, other floors were shut down. So we had a lot of support of nurses that were floated to other areas to help us. Mm-hmm. But still, yeah. Wait, where was I going with that? What was your question?
My question was advocacy, because we're so separated. And they weren't getting food, and they were on high oxygen, but they weren't getting food, and so it was about advocacy. How do we advocate when we're so far away?
Right. So then, you know, we have, and we're saying we're in this pandemic, and so our charting didn't have to be up to par. Right. And the hospital's all over. They were like, we're not going to ding you. Just do the best you can. And this is the mentality that we're going out there with. So how best can you do it? I say this. If CDC is saying that a person needs to be isolated for 10 days after their first symptom, then that is what we should be going by. Right. Because hospitals are saying, you know, they're flip-flopping. They use CDC when they want to, then they make things up when they want to, right? I don't know who they're talking to, how they're coming up with this policy, but surely if a nurse can walk into a room and walk into multiple rooms, multiple times of the day, put on PPE, get off of work, and go to the grocery store, go work out, how are you telling a family member that they can't sit at the bedside with their patient? Have them sign a waiver. Yeah. You know, I found this amazing website, and it's allieschultz.com. And I'll send that to you. She's here in Arizona. I found her from truthforhealth.org. And she has a really good, you know, patient's rights. Like a patient has a bill of rights when they're in the hospital. People need to know their state and know what their patient bill's rights are, you know, and advocate for that. I mean, I'm also part of the helping out with American Frontline Nurses, American Frontline Nurses, and we're starting to train nurse advocates. We're doing our first one on the 20th. To get people to help, because I get phone calls all day and I'm not even publicizing myself, but it's a constant need, and it's going to be worse. So yes, know your patient bill of rights, ask them for their infection control procedures in writing. Go to that website because she has it all there for you.
The Allie Schultz one, the Allie Schultz website.
Yeah,
A-L-I. Okay. Yeah, and we'll have that in the description too, because I think that's really important. When my friend was going in the hospital last year for breast cancer, not COVID, but because she was tested for COVID on the ER floor and had a positive test, Few days later, a negative one. Few days later, a positive one. Few days later, a negative one. They kept this immune compromised woman on the COVID floor. It felt like prison. When I wanted to go visit her and I was forbidden to go visit my friend, she's dying. She had metastatic breast cancer. She only had months to live because she wasn't getting treatment at this time. We were stopped at the door by a whole bunch of people, and I had to get like tested with my fever or whatever, and I couldn't even enter the hospital. They wouldn't even, and I wanted to like go hold her hand, go talk to her, go see her, and it was so devastating to be so separated from her, and I could only
Right.
imagine what her husband was going through, just by getting separated because she had a positive test, even though she had breast cancer, metastatic breast cancer, and we were forbidden to
Right.
go see her. And so it was really hard for him to advocate because it was at their discretion when they wanted to call him back and when we wanted to talk to him. And then the same thing with my dad. He was a transplant patient, and I couldn't see him the last week of his life because they still had the hospital protocols for the COVID. My mom was able to be there. He could have one visitor, and she was able to see him the last week of his life. And then I had a sister, and my uncle came, and it was really hard because I wanted to go be with my dad, and I didn't know he was dying actually at that moment. But I think that the blinders caused my dad to die because he was talking about heart issues in February, and he ended up dying from an infection eating away at his heart valve. And I feel like, well, perhaps it was just that fog that Dr. McCullough talks about. And maybe if they didn't have that COVID fog, maybe my dad would still be alive today. But at that moment, I didn't know my dad was going to die that week. And I was trying to go down to the
Yeah.
hospital and forbidden. And so these COVID restrictions really, really personally affected me. And two people I loved was forbidden to go and see them, and they ended up passing away. I was able to see my dad like in the process of him dying, but he couldn't talk. And you know how it is when a patient dies, all their limbs start going cold. That's when I was able to go see my dad. And it's because of these COVID protocols that I feel like are awful and shouldn't be where they are, especially with a 99.9% success rate. And if you get those ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, get the prophylactic going on, that means you're gonna start supporting your immune system now. Go to drstellamd.com, use promo code AmberMay, one word, or go get her Covivites. I feel like this should never be, and you shouldn't have to be separated from your loved one because you can't advocate for them. You don't know that they're not being fed in the hospital. When you're sick in the hospital, how do you really give informed consent to the physician and the nurse when you really don't feel that great? You really don't
Right.
feel that great. So you're not really able to really process all that information because you don't feel that great. Where if you had your loved one right next to them, they could be like, he's experiencing this, or in the middle of an emergency, maybe you've done your rounds and you're with a patient and my loved one is having an emergency. If there's no patient advocate there, you're going to have no clue that your patient's having an emergency because you're in another room with another patient where I can come out and say, hey, I need help. I need help. I need help. Someone get in here. And then you like, oh, this is not an emergency. I'll go run to my patient and take care of my patient. So it's really jeopardizing in my mind just being on the patient side, not the medical clinic side. The patient side, I feel like we're better protecting, even if you're going to limit. Like they did with my dad, even if they're going to limit, at least give somebody the opportunity to advocate for the loved one because I feel like it's a disservice to the people that are. I felt like hospitals became like a jail,
Yeah.
and I it's just been the last 2 years. It's been really difficult to even step foot in the hospital because it just felt like a jail feeling where, especially with my friend with the breast cancer, and I'm stopped at the door. I can't even give her a goodie bag. They're like, oh, we'll give it to her. I mean, it was just
How about like
heartbreaking.
talk about prayer in the hospital? There's, people that have their faith that want to go and lay hands on them and pray. I mean, that's under the Bill of Rights. Like, you
Right.
can practice your religious freedom. That's what I'm saying. There, people need to know what that is, and we have got to push back We have got to push back from these arbitrary, unscientific protocols. And not stand for it. And it just, like, I mean, talking to you, I sit there and say, like, how am I one of the only ones? And when people say, oh, I'm brave or courageous.
You are.
I'm like, no, I'm fed up.
But you are brave, and I'm fed up too. I'm with you 100% fed up. And that's why I wanted you on the show, because you are brave, and you're brave because we have physicians still pushing some medications that are killing people. And they're just afraid to say something because they don't want to lose their job or they don't want to lose their medical license. And I totally understand that. You've been through school a long time. You put a lot of hours and a lot of work into getting your license. I understand that. But are you going to be able to look yourself in the mirror because of the things that are going on inside your hospitals? And are you doing no harm? You went into the hospital. You went in to become a physician. You went in to become a nurse because you wanted to help people and heal people and care about people. You had these noble things that God put inside of you. But right now, those noble things aren't happening because patients are getting separated from their loved ones. They're not getting the nutrition. They're getting remdesivir. They're having the mask put on their face. They're having these unscientific things being put on their face or in their bodies or whatever. And it's harming people. And so you are brave because, yes, you know, your job was on the line when you came out and Project Veritas. But I feel like God is going to honor you and bless you. And I don't know, you know, you got a job now with the frontline doctors. I don't know.
No, it's free.
I had a feeling. But, well, I mean, because you stepped out in faith, I'm sure God is going to somehow, some way help you. Take care of you. I'm reading the book of Elijah right now, and God, in the most desperate situation with a drought, God always provided everything that Elijah needed: shelter, food, water. He provided everything. And so what I'm encouraging my medical professional friends like you, Jody, I just want to speak that into your life. You know, if you get nervous about, you know, maybe your situation, your living situation, that God will provide for you, Jody. God's going to give you food, water, shelter. He's going to provide the basic needs. He even tells us in the Gospels, hey, if God can provide the birds of the air with food and shelter, and he can dress the fields as beautiful as King Solomon himself, won't God take care of you even more? And I have to say that God's going to honor what you did, Jody, because you're teaching people that there's things going on in the hospital that aren't safe. It's not scientific. And people like me need to know that, because we don't know medicine. Okay. We don't. We can see with our eyes what's going on, and critical thinking makes you like, and I'll look into stuff. And that's how I've been discovering things, which you're backing up everything I'm saying. Dr. Peter McCullough backed up everything I'm saying. Dr. Stella, and I had another nurse, everything that I've been finding out, all of you guys have been verifying my information and saying, yes, what you've been finding is true. But there's some people that feel like they don't have the time to go research it because they're running from here to here to here to here just to keep their life going. So all they hear is the mainstream media or their news on Facebook, and that's it. And so what I love about this opportunity is I'm that one person that they can get their news on their phone and hear it when they're driving, or see it on the social media, listen to it, and get the truth out that way. So that's what I love about this platform that I'm on, because it gives me an opportunity, gives you an opportunity to reach those people that normally wouldn't go do the research themselves because they feel like, I can't, I have my kids and this and work and da-da-da. So it's a beautiful place for me to be, that I can be that, like, hey, I've done the research and here are the experts and they've done the research.
Much needed. Yeah. Yes, much needed, because I would do that driving to work. I'd put on a podcast. I'd put on a sermon. I'd wake up, you know, get ready. And I would be listening and educating and, you know, myself and getting fed, you know, with the spirit, you know, this entire time, you know, I asked God, just use me. Because when I asked him to allow me to get off of Facebook and stop posting and stop educating, and he was like, no, we're keeping you on. And how do I know that? Because I would get these random messages, because people don't comment, you know, don't worry about it. Don't do it. If God lays something on your heart, you know, don't do it for the likes or the notoriety or anything like that. Do it because you are fulfilling something he is asking you to do.
Correct.
And that's what I just continue to do. And just at the, and when I just put my hands up and I was like, okay, I guess I still have to stay on Facebook because Lori Smith just reached out to me and said that I, my post helped her from killing herself. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
oh, I know exactly what you mean, Jody, because I've been wanting to get off Facebook too. And I just haven't been able to because there's still people that I get to send my stuff to. And it's been helping them. And as much as I want to, like, get off that horrible platform, I just haven't had the release yet, just like you. And so I'm encouraging anyone who's listening, if they have a tug in their heart, you need to obey that tug. If you're a physician and you don't like what's going on in your hospitals, then it's up to you to start your own practice. And I have a friend who knows somebody that's willing to finance physicians who want to open their own clinic. And she's actually the tax incentive agency person. And the link is already in the description. She knows somebody. So reach out to her. There's an email there with credits at something, something, something. There's an email. Reach out to her. She knows somebody. We're also working with senators here in Arizona to help with funding for people. I don't know where that's going to go exactly, but at least we're in the talks with senators to get funding for those physicians who want to open their own practice. So I don't know where that will go, but at least that's down the road. So hopefully it'll go somewhere and it will help the physicians out there. But I want to say bravery begets bravery. And so if you are afraid that you're going to lose your job or your license right now, there's a lot of other doctors that have said, no, I'm not doing this. And so I would encourage you to stand alongside them and say, no, I can't give remdesivir. No, I can't do this. This is unscientific. And stand with them. Give them the ivermectin. Give them the hydroxychloroquine. Give actual real medication that the patients actually need. And stand like Jody. Be as brave as Jody, because I understand when the livelihood is at stake, then things are scary. But you know what? Everyone's livelihood is at stake right now because they're forcing a jab on everybody. So everybody's job is at stake, not just the doctors. Everybody's job is at stake. So now is the time to say...
go ahead.
I was going to say, just now is the time to be brave and say no. Just say no.
Mm-hmm. And Peter McCullough, Dr. McCullough, he says it best. He says, what's the social contract? Meaning you go and take the jab. Well, is your job safe for 3 months, six months before they want you to do another one? And then you're going to do it again. You know, that, and that puts it in perspective for people. It's like, it's like a battered wife. Right. They just can't keep getting beat down and beat down and beat down, that then you look up one day and you're just a shell of yourself. And trust me, I was there too. I stayed in abusive relationships 3 times in my life. And when I walked out of it, I mean, I looked like somebody that, you know, belonged in Walmart. In the middle of the night.
Yeah. We know those people.
And I'd look at myself and be like, oh my gosh, this is me? Mm-hmm. What did I do to myself? What did I let this person do to me? And this person is Big Pharma, who's making money.
Oh yeah.
And they're pushing a narrative. So stand up. Mm-hmm. Say, you know, go to community. I say so much now, like you said, listen to that little whisper. Because God is not going to call you to do something and then forsake you.
Right. Exactly.
Fellowship. Figure out ways to fellowship and be around people. Because people need people more now than they ever have. And there's people struggling and wanting that support. But, you know, we just got to we gotta hit them on an emotional level, because propaganda is real. It works. We saw what that did in World War II. They're doing it again to us.
Yeah.
And we have to realize that we need to wake up. And you got to hit people on an emotional level. That's where they have the opportunity to wake up out of their trance. Like Dr. McCullough said, legit, people are in a trance.
And the worst thing is, fear. I just don't want moms and dads to be misinformed, because there was that council with the FDA that said, do not give this to children, the shot. And yet now the FDA is like, we're going to give it to kids and get the shot. And we have seen young people with myocarditis And that's permanent. There's no, once you got heart damage, it's permanent. And I just, if my show can touch at least one parent so that they protect their kid from not getting the shot when the council on the FDA said, do not give this to children, I don't want any parent to feel like, to be burying their child or dealing with permanent disabilities, whether it's neurological, whether it's cardiovascular, whatever it is. I just want the kids to be protected. And right now, with parents trying to trust what the CDC and the FDA said that are getting paid by Big Pharma, I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there so you guys can really think about that decision before you
I
make that decision.
agree. I agree. I agree. We have got to protect our children. I mean, I was screaming from the rooftops, take that mask off of them. Allow them to breathe. What they have done to them psychologically, we will never know the true effects of what that has done. To say that you need to put a mask on because you could kill someone by your breath. When they see people out there going to concerts and gathering together, but they think that they're going to do that and they're helping humanity. Now you've got that same parent that's going to inject them with something that we have zero clue how that's going to be long term. We know what happened short term, and that is a lot of side effects for something that they have a 99.999, they have more of a chance to get struck by lightning.
Yeah, and then this disease wasn't really affecting the children.
No.
And so it's like, why are we even talking about the children right now? So if I'm blessed that God called me to do this show again, and if I get to help families, then that makes it all worth it, because we all feel those inadequacies when God calls us to do something. But I feel like I'm given the opportunity to help people, and that's what I enjoy doing, is helping people. And if you want to be a part of what we're doing, join us on Telegram at AZ Super Moms. You don't have to be a mom, you don't have to be a parent. All it was just started by some super moms in Arizona. And what I love about Arizona is we had the audit, and then we have a nurse who is speaking the truth. And God is really using Arizona for some reason, I don't know, maybe because we're the Wild West and we don't take no, we're fighters, we're the cowboy country. I don't know what it is, but God is using Arizona to pave the way for all the United States. And so join us at AZ Super Moms. You can be, there's men in our group. Like, again, it's not just moms. Check out my website at theambermayshow.com. Check out some of the merch on there. Check out the promo codes. If you're an employer, please submit your non-jab jobs to me. I would love that. Thank you so much, Jody O'Malley, for joining us today on the Amber May Show. Thanks for being brave. Thanks for obeying God, when he called you to do what you did. I was just like, when I watched you on Project Veritas, I was cheering. I was like, finally, we had someone being brave to get out there like that. So I appreciate you doing that. And I know God is gonna bless you for doing what you did. And so I want to thank you for giving me your time today.
You're very welcome. If I may, I would like to also just shout out We the Patriots USA.org. They have donated the retainer for my attorney that's helping me with my case. So really want to be, shout them out.
We the
Look them up.
Patriot, what? We the
We
Patriot.
the Patriots USA.org.
USA.org.
And my Nurse for Natives IG account. I'm sharing information there, although I just got shadow banned, so we'll see how long that lasts. But I also have a Telegram channel too. And then for patient advocacy and helping out, look at AmericanFrontlineNurses.com. And also too, to the people that have supported me with my Give, Send, Go, I'm super thankful for that. We got a couple more cases that are coming up from people that are trying to sue me. If you feel led on your heart to go there and donate $5, that's very much appreciated.
That's give,
And that's,
send, go.
yeah, /vaccine whistleblower.
Okay, I'm gonna put all this on my website, on the description, I mean. Awesome.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Send and just text me the links too, just to make sure I get them correct.
I will. Yes, I
Thank you
will.
so much. I appreciate that.
Thank you. You have a blessed day.
You too.